So thank you again for having me here, and thank you everyone for joining. It feels quite tender for me to be here. This is the first thing I'm doing here in the new year. I'm sort of still in vacation mode. My family just and I just got back from a little time off, and my mom is coming to visit tomorrow for the weekend. So my heart feels very open and tender. So I wanted to share a little bit tonight about this theme of how our practice can be a resource in these really challenging times. I've been reflecting a lot just with the end of the year on where we are collectively. 2024, almost a quarter of a century into the new century. And how much has changed in the last, just even the last few years. I have a sense that perhaps many of you do as well, that 2020 was a kind of turning point, I think, for hu the human civilization on the planet. The pandemic revealed our interconnectedness. In ways that I think was not as clear or apparent to many. Even those of us who practice and understand or have insight into emptiness, interdependence, interconnection, on a spiritual level, on a heart level, on a philosophical level, to really see and experience directly how interdependent our lives actually are shifted something, I think, in our consciousness. And the events that have unfolded since then, here in the United States, around the world, I think have really tipped us into a new phase, is my sense of things. George Floyd's murder was this kind of cultural and spiritual upheaval and a reckoning with the forces of violence and racism here in the United States. The wildfires that happened in 2020, which brought climate change into our view in a new way. This was the context within which I started writing my book. In 2020, and really looking at how can our meditation practice and the broader sense of the Buddha's teachings on living a meaningful life through contemplation, how can that be a meaningful resource with everything that's happening? And then the last year or two, just the January 6th insurrection, the war in Ukraine, the conflict in the Middle East. And all of the news that's coming out about the climate of 2023 was the hottest year on record. If you look at the graphs, it's frightening. And you know, we see the effects happening continually. And the ripple effects of the changes in our climate in terms of the refugee situation and the pressure on resources and economies. So my experience, both just personally and also as someone who gets to interact with a lot of people in my role, is that a lot of us are still kind of catching up emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, with the world that we're living in today. And it feels like the rate of change is increasing rapidly. And I know there are theories that point to the fact that every generation, right, has the experience of it feels like the world is ending. It's never been like this before. The change is happening more quickly. So it may be difficult to parse out how much is that just this iteration of that phenomena. Although the changes of climate seem particularly unique in their capacity to undermine the life support systems of the planet. In many ways, similar to the threat of nuclear war, I think, in the previous generation. So, given all of this that we're living through, what resources do we have to bring to bear on all of this? And certainly, our meditation practice is a huge one. We know, though, that the path the Buddha taught is about so much more than formal meditation practice. The whole Noble Eightfold Path is a way of life. And I think that one thing that James and I have in common in terms of our teaching and our passion, I'm catching up to you, James, where you've been, is giving sufficient attention to this factor of right effort, which within the context of meditation, particularly if you sit retreats or go to Dharma talks and Dharma groups, often gets talked about as, not too tight, not too loose, just applying enough energy. But actually, right effort is about how we are cultivating our hearts and our minds. As James was saying earlier, the talk he's giving at Sangha Live this weekend and his whole work on awakening joy, learning to change the channel, learning that we have this capacity to choose where we place our attention and what we cultivate, what we actively bring in, and what we actively set aside. My book, Your Heart Was Made for This, is an exploration of how do we shape our inner life? How do we train the heart? One of the analogies that the Buddha uses is that there are seeds in our consciousness. He kind of has this metaphor of the heart, the mind, as very fertile soil. And every thought, every word, every action is like a seed. And that soil of the heart mind is so fertile that whatever seeds we plant, they're going to grow. The challenge is that we don't exist in neutral conditions. The modern world and society is not a neutral field. So there are seeds being watered all of the time by the field around us. So if we don't take an active role in cultivating, tending, gardening our own heart, the world is going to do that for us. I see a lot of familiar names and faces here tonight. Really touched to be together. And as some of you who know me, know that my wife and I had a child a little over a year ago. Our son is 15 months old now. And one of the things, particularly as he's kind of coming into awareness more and being more relational and learning so much, that's just remarkable to me is the purity with which we come into this world. And how malleable and impressionable our hearts are. With a child that young, you can kind of see the shaping happening. They're taking in everything so fully. Every experience is a learning interaction. There's millions of neural connections being formed every day. It's amazing. The rate of growth and change. And that process continues. The rate slows down as we grow, but that learning process continues. One of the analogies that I like to use, we come into this world, human beings, with the capacity to learn any language. Our neurology is primed to detect the phonemes, the sounds of language around us, including pitch and tone. As well as grammar, and can learn any language. In a similar way, and so what do we do with that capacity, right? Do we just learn one language? Are we able to, if we're exposed to it, learn two, sometimes three languages? Very easy when we're that young to absorb languages. Our heart is also endowed with these innate capacities to develop and grow these beautiful qualities. And some of them seem to be present in certain forms from the very beginning. Qualities like joy or delight or generosity. before language is even forming, the impulse to share food is right there and to take delight in that. Other capacities are dormant but growing and available, like equanimity. Newborns have zero equanimity. They are so raw, so reactive because everything is so overwhelming. But just to see, even in the first 6 months or the first year, how the human organism adapts to it, its environment, just on a purely on a pure level of sensation. How equanimity develops through experience, that capacity for non-reactivity. And then, of course, the emotional equanimity is slower to develop. So, what capacities are we nourishing? Given that we have this range, this repertoire to grow and develop such beautiful qualities. So, one of the central themes of Dharma practice and of really engaged on the ground Dharma practice is that we're always practicing something. We're always learning something, teaching ourselves something. So, how do we go through our day? If we practice being impatient and rushed and frustrated, we get really good at being impatient and feeling rushed and being frustrated, finding fault in others, belittling ourselves. If we practice intentionally being patient, being kind, being generous, noticing beauty, taking delight, we get really good at being patient and kind and generous, taking delight and joy. So this insight and this kind of training of our heart and our mind is one aspect of contemplative practice. And I think this is a kind of medicine for our modern times to really begin to heal some of the fragmentation, the alienation, the overwhelm, the heartache that is so endemic to our world. And also through developing these capacities, these qualities to empower us, to engage effectively and contribute our gifts. But as we begin to understand this process, what's available to us and how to engage with it, everything in our life starts to become a training ground for awakening and for building the world we want to live in. Because as we build inner resources, as we develop more inner resources, we increase our capacity to be with suffering and to serve. We have more and more moments where we become an island of sanity. An island of sanity in a sea of confusion, fear, pain, anger. This is the invitation of living a life of Dhamma, is to use this heart, this mind, this body to realize our potential to cultivate these incredible capacities and then live them, offer them. And the whole process begins. This is the last thing I'll share, and then I want to engage a little with James, who spent so many decades exploring this, and also then hear from all of you and learn together. The whole process begins and continues and is sustained with how we pay attention. So our attention is a very valuable resource. It's a resource that has been monetized by technology and advertising and persuasive design. And it's a resource that we can reclaim and have more agency over. When we're aware, every moment we have a choice about where we're placing our attention. What are we attending to? So this is directed by our intention. What's important to us? How are we orienting? Are we being driven by greed, by fear, by reactivity? Are we being driven by interest, curiosity, kindness, compassion? And then those intentions help us to notice what aspects of this experience of being alive and embodied are we attending to? So externally, who am I spending time with? What activities am I engaging with? What am I consuming? There's so many ways to renew ourselves without reaching for a device or feeding an addiction, looking at a tree, taking a walk, art, music, exercise, poetry, dance, learning, spending time with friends. Internally, how are we living? Where are we placing our attention? Are we focusing on all of our faults or nursing resentment, replaying regrets, worrying about the future? Or internally, are we able to use this capacity to be conscious and aware to start to nourish the healthy, beautiful seeds in consciousness, to appreciate our blessings, to focus on gratitude, to connect with joy? Not because we're avoiding the pain and suffering in our lives and in the world, but because we truly recognize and understand that to engage with that in an honest and a useful way, we need some buoyancy. We need some lightness. We need an inner ground. So this process of cultivating, training the heart, allows us to meet the challenges we're living through with awareness, to develop relationship with what's happening, and then to respond more appropriately, more wisely. So there's so much more I could say about this process and the different qualities and some of the things I share in the book, but I think I want to stop here so that there's more time for conversation and engagement, which I tend to enjoy more and I feel is often richer. So thank you for your kind attention thus far. And how's all that landing with you, James? What's on your mind or in your heart?
Yeah, I'm right with you, and it is all about habits, and it seems, what seeds that you water, and wondering what you have to say to people who see that there's a way to greater well-being and have a strong desire to cultivate, but the habits have been so strong that even though they wish they could be cultivating in a greater towards greater ease and peace and love and the things that you mentioned, there's a frustration at how hard it is, and a discouragement at, who am I kidding? Will I ever overcome all of these habits that I've cultivated over a lifetime? I wonder if you have something to say about that.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, James. I mean, I can certainly relate. I think we all can. And to just broaden the question a little, it's, their internal obstacles, all of the habits, the frustration, trauma that you're pointing to. And then there's all of the external challenges, right? Of not having downtime, working two or three jobs, or taking care of parents or children. Or so I think we face those kind of obstacles and challenges internally and externally. I think for me, in both regards, some of the places that I draw support from and would offer, there's kind of a few. One is aspiration. I find that it's so essential to have a sense of one's North Star and to really keep attending to and nourishing the point that you started with of just the sense of what's possible. Right? It's like the Buddha said, if this weren't possible, I wouldn't ask you to do it. It's because it's possible that I'm saying, like, cultivate the good, the beautiful. Let it inform your life. And I think we need that. We need to hold fast to our vision. We talk a lot about letting go in this practice, but there's certain things that we want to hold on to. We want to really connect with and strengthen. And that sense of our vision of what's possible, I think, is really important. You know, the first World Social Forum, I think it was in the 80s, just that very simple phrase, another world is possible. Like four words, collective aspiration. I have a dream, Dr. King's speech, si se puede. It's like that sense of what are we heading towards is so important for us, whether we're looking at personal transformation or social transformation. So that's one, and that it brings energy. It can bring energy personally. It can bring energy collectively. It can galvanize a whole people, right? When we have a sense of where we're headed and what we long for. So that for me is really essential. It's why it's the second chapter in my book. The first is attention. The second is aspiration. It's why the Buddha put it at the beginning of the five powers, the five spiritual faculties, right? Saddha, faith, aspiration. So there's that. I think another, there's maybe two or three more. So, and I'll try to be concise so we have time for more exploration. I think another is not underestimating the power of small moments. I think we can get into a very kind of mechanistic, linear mindset about healing and transformation. Well, I have 50 or 60 years of conditioning and so many years of trauma and only this much time to meditate, and how will I ever? And it's not a linear process. And thank God. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just one moment, like Thich Nhat Hanh used to say, a moment of mindfulness is a moment of freedom. One moment of gratitude. Such a powerful seed. Because as we know, like, one seed can grow a tree that can produce thousands of seeds. So, you know, you're overwhelmed and I can't meet rent and I might lose my job and I'm on the bus, and instead of pulling out the phone, like, to just close the eyes and rest for a moment, like that moment of rest has infinite potential to transform us. This is another thing that I take a lot of refuge and encouragement from. And then two more things I'll just mention briefly. One is just compassion and forgiveness for ourselves. Like, we're all doing the best we can. And I think the more tender we can be with ourselves, the more enjoyable the process is. And then connecting, reaching out, not doing it alone as much as possible, having that support from others, the encouragement of others, others reflecting back our good qualities to us, all of those things are essential. And I know for myself that some of the hardest times I've had in my life, whether it's being ill or feeling lonely or lost, it's other people that have shown up and, you know, amazingly been able to be there, say something, offer encouragement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all of those, I really appreciate your naming all of those, and the power of good friends and of compassion, and just want to, if it's okay to go one
absolutely
one
please
step
yeah,
further.
What
one of the most challenging aspects of practice sometimes is when you have all of these supports and you're practicing self-compassion, you know, but there you are. I remember giving a talk ages ago. I know I'm stuck and I still can't get out.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the support, you have, you're practicing, you know, to some extent, self-compassion and these things. And the habits are so strong that there's this sense of discouragement. who was I kidding? Yeah, those moments where you can land and really let them in, you know, I agree, are really profound. But how to, if I can go one step further, just how to deal with that discouragement of how deeply ingrained the habits are. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, here we are at the beginning of the year where New Year's resolutions are, you know, what everybody tries to do. And it takes a special kind of mind and heart and intention to really shift and make a change. And I'm just wondering if you could say any other words about that changing of habits that don't serve us, even Absolutely. When we know better. Yeah.
Yeah. And don't we all? Thank you. I think for me, what's been helpful are two things that have been helpful. One is patience. There's a reason that the Buddha said patience is the highest virtue. You know, everything ends. So even it's like when we're stuck in whatever that habit is, or we find ourselves, you know, needing to renew the resolution once again for the umpteenth time, it's like just a sense of patience of like, this is not permanent. This is not forever. However tenacious this habit feels, just that sense of patience and trust in impermanence, so the patience to allow ourselves and allow the knotted habits in the heart to have space and time. It takes time for these habits to shift. Patience. There's a certain connected to that, you know, there's a certain quality of surrender, I think, that comes. There's that beautiful Rumi poem that ends, you know, at last spring has come and I have no will left. Like, will can only take us so far. There's a certain point at which we need to let go and surrender, even to the sense of like, I can't do this. And that's not a defeat. It's not a giving up. It's a kind of releasing into grace. Like, it's okay. There's an aspect of patience and also renunciation that includes that kind of surrender. And then the other aspect is there's something I think powerful and important about developing respect for what we call in Buddhism, the kalesa, the harmful habits of our heart and mind. They're so tenacious. They're so powerful. Mm-hmm. And when we're stuck in some habit and we feel discouraged and I can't do it, instead of focusing on my failure, what if we look at the insight that's present? That's like, wow, look how hard this is. Here I am, clear, with good intentions, with resources, with teachings, like whatever the conditions are, and it's still so hard. How did the Buddha get free? It's so amazing. Wow, I've got my work cut out for me. You know, if we're engaging with, if you use a metaphor of, when I was a kid, I spent a few years at summer camp wrestling. I'm not a big sportsman, but I wrestled a little bit. And you need to feel your opponent. You need to have a sense of how strong are they? How quick are they? How much do they weigh in relation to me? So we make a New Year's resolution. We're like, I'm going to do this. And, you know, after a week or two, you're like, oh, like, this is going to be harder than I thought. That's really important information. So the failures are actually, you know, if we're seeing them that way as failures, they're really useful information about the strength of our opponent, if we're going to use that kind of a battle metaphor for the defilements and the negative habits, harmful habits in our mind. So we develop respect, and we also learn from that discouragement what we're really up against. And that can then feed into energy, aspiration, patience, all of the wholesome qualities that are there to support us. I think it's also essential to not take any of it personally, right? To really just recognize, like, these are just different forces playing out. And just moment by moment, the more I can feed the healthy ones, they're going to do the work.
Yeah, that is a key, not to take it personally. And you're reminding me of a line I love by Pema Chodron, who says, take delight in the awareness that sees the dukkha. Instead of being discouraged at, oh, there's so much suffering here or so much confusion, oh, there's an awareness that's seeing it. And if you focus on that rather than the pothole that you just fell in again, oh, it's like the Buddha saying, oh, I see you, Mara. And if you can feel uplifted by the fact that you're seeing it, even though you're in the hole, that's the first step out. So, well, and one more thing, and then I'll just, then we can open up to everyone. Your book has lots of practices about, opening up to the hard stuff, and, you know, what your heart was made for this, and its practices to cultivate. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, practice. Absolutely. And at the risk of, I don't know, being a little geeky or to self-promotion. I know a lot of folks have the book already, folks who follow me, but I love the cover. I love how it came out so much. It's so pretty. It's a beautiful rainbow.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so each chapter focuses on a healthy quality or capacity. Many of the ones we've been mentioning, like joy, patience, renunciation, mindfulness, energy, aspiration, other things like rest, ease, play. And then each chapter ends with a reflection. So something to kind of chew on or think about, a meditation, and then an action, something that you can do, some way to embody this or explore embodying it in your life. And then there's a section on difficulties, so common challenges that arise and tips for how to engage with those. And the idea, each chapter is relatively short, 10, 12 pages. The idea is that you can read it in an evening or two, and then take some time with it, take a week or more, to just practice with the quality and see where it shows up in your life and what the effect is. So my hope is that it can be a very kind of practical companion for people in their life. And each chapter stands on its own. So it can be kind of a fun choose your own adventure where you say, okay, like, what do I need this week? And you can look through the table of contents. Of course, it has its own arc and its own structure as well, but it doesn't need to be used that way. And my hope is also, because these are such universal qualities like forgiveness or compassion, is that courses, other fields, groups that are looking at a particular quality might be able to just like pull a chapter and read it as a reference point or a way of having discussion or exploring these aspects of what it is to be human.
Beautiful. Yeah, it's a beautiful book.
And thank you for, James was one of the people who read a few of the chapters in their early draft and offered some very useful feedback that affected the whole book in terms of some of the things you pointed to. So I thank you for that as well, James.
Yeah. That I could be part of a beautiful product. Well, so we can open it up now to questions. And yeah, if you want, there's the reaction box at the very at the bottom of your screen. And if you hit on that icon at the bottom of all the icon selections, there's a raise hand, and then can see you and bring you up to the the front. And here's Liz Wiener, a good friend, an old friend.
Yes, haven't seen you, James, for many, many years.
Yeah.
When I came from living in the monastery in Nova Scotia, you were the first Buddhist teacher I met when I came down 25 years ago. I just want to thank both of you. Our teachers are enormously important, just enormously important. You are guides for us. You are examples. Your devotion is so inspiring, and I'm so thankful to you. This is a journey. I'm 84 now. Horrors. How did that happen? And I met James when I was, I think, 65. And I'm experiencing an enormous amount of fruition, and I feel so grateful. And it's so surprising in many ways. But I've put my energy into it for over 25 years. There is fruition if one sticks with it. And we need your example. Like, was it Thich Nhat Hanh in the boat who said, as long as there's one person in the boat? Mm-hmm. You know that one. Maybe you could elucidate that a little better. But we need your examples of generosity and kindness. Also, I love the concept, which I recently learned, of common humanity, that we all feel mostly the same things to some degree or other. We're all on the path together, and it is a journey. It's a lifetime journey.
Thank you, Liz.
Thank you
for being here, both of you.
Okay, so thank you for that. And how about Jude Pollock? I can ask you to unmute, and I'll bring you up on the, whoops.
Hi. I was actually just trying to write the heart and the hand raised. So I just want to say hi and thank you so much to both of you.
Okay. Good to hear from you, Jude. How about, let's see, Suzanne, and I'll ask to unmute. There you go. Hi.
Hi. I think it was a really good evening for me to come here because I've been thinking a lot about our capacity to stay in tenderness when either eternally things are going on and also externally. And sometimes I wonder about like what is our capacity, because you know, just even genetically, that you know, now because of the internet and just having access to things that are going on throughout the world, as well as originally in the past, it'd be our nuclear families or our communities, and trying to cope with that as an individual in that. And but now we have mapped onto it that the whole world, and how to just how to stay in a tender and loving place and not numb out because I'm at full capacity or I can't do something. And so it's just something that I've been trying to figure out how to balance.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, Suzanne. I think it's a challenge probably most of us are going through today. And it's, you know, just to kind of add to what you're saying, I don't think it's just the fact that we have access to kind of global information. It's also that information is being filtered in a very specific way. And there are different filters, of course, but we're not hearing about all of the generosity and all of the love and all of the compassion and all of the goodness that's happening around the world every day in communities everywhere. right? We're hearing about the violence and the horror and the tragedy. And so, you know, and that's quite being quite specifically and intentionally filtered for various reasons. So I think there are these levels of challenge in how much information we have access to. It's one of the reasons why I think it's so important to have a conscious practice around how, when, and why we consume the news. And to really bring our practice into that. And, you know, there's the extremes. We know this is the middle path. So there's the extreme of those who say, I don't look at the news because there's nothing I can do about it, and completely cut off, which has its benefits, but also its limitations, liabilities, and, you know, some kind of detrimental consequences. And then there's the other extreme, right, of being totally absorbed and addicted. And we might go back and forth between the two. So one of the things that I talk about in the book, and there's many good tips out there. I mean, if you just kind of even Google, like, how to read the news mindfully, there's some good articles that come up, including one that I wrote on my website. But I think one of the most essential things to add to the conversation of all of the good tips that are out there about setting limits and being mindful and feeling your body and is knowing your purpose. Why? Why are we looking at the news? What is our motivation and what is our purpose? How much is enough? We don't know how much is enough if we don't know what our purpose is. Mm-hmm. Are there particular issues that we're following? And if so, why? You know, when we have a reason and we're engaged, then the news takes on a different meaning because we're there for a reason. And when we get the information we need, we know that it's enough. So if there's an issue that you're following and engaged with, like homelessness or the climate or racial justice, or you focus and you get information to inform you about that so that you can respond and engage in a different way. Mm-hmm. Whereas when it's just this kind of pervasive sense of not knowing, or I need to keep up, or then it's very difficult to make more conscious choices about when is enough and how much and why. So I think this is one of the things that I find very helpful for myself, is knowing, like, what are the things I'm focusing on and why? And, you know, in terms of having a sense of what's happening generally, so that, you know, I'm informed and, you know what's affecting people's consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's helpful.
Yeah. And then all of the other things that we practice and teach, of course, right, in terms of equanimity and compassion and finding joy to nourish us, all of those come into play as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Susan. Yeah.
Thanks. Let's see, anyone else have something that they want to ask or share? You want to raise your hand?
Or you could type something in the chat as well. We probably have time for one more question or comment.
And if not, I have something to explore. I just want to give people a chance. Anything you want to step up to the screen? Okay, well then, here's someone, Google.
Okay, so Steve's just sharing source for good news.
Good news, nice news for uplifting stories. Mm-hmm. Yes, and okay, Ellen, I see you, and I'll just first add your spotlight and then ask you to unmute and see. There you go. Whoops. Wait, do it one more time. There you go.
Hi, thank you so much for having this opportunity. My sister lives in Israel, and my nephew is his birthday is today, and he is in the Israel Defense Force. Was called to duty after serving for 4 years. And my sister had been visiting here in September and returned to Israel after 18 days on October 4th. And then on the 7th, we know what happened. So what happens when you're just really scared and your heart is breaking for what's happening with the Israelis, with the Palestinians, with all the misinformation, how the global community has turned against Israel, against Jews on campus. My son's at Cornell, which has a lot of anti-Semitism going on. So, I mean, how I'm trying to stay open-hearted, have hope and faith, and I'm just breaking. And I know you say your heart is made for this, but I just don't know. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ellen. Appreciate you sharing your tenderness with us and your heartbreak. There are things that happen in our lives, in our world, where we say, my heart wasn't made for this. And there's a truth in that, you know, and I think being real about that is essential and is kind of the only way forward. I think it's important to, when we have the privilege to take care of ourselves, to do that. You know, when we're not in an active war zone and have the relative safety to take a walk in the park or, I don't know, take a hot bath. But it's essential to nourish ourselves and take care of ourselves when we're experiencing heartbreak, whether it's heartbreak over these kinds of larger forces like war and hatred, whether it's hatred of Jews or hatred of Muslims or hatred of Arabs or Palestinians or the dehumanization that is somehow embedded in our sort of tribal inheritance as animals. I don't think we can be part of the healing that's called for if we're not also taking care of ourselves. So it's a both and. I know you know this. But taking care of your pain is essential. The story that Liz was referring to was one that Thich Nhat Hanh tells about refugees from Vietnam fleeing in boats in the Gulf of Siam, and how many of them would capsize and die, as we see today happening from North Africa to Europe, a similar situation. And he is saying that, you know, even one person who's calm and lucid can save many lives because they know what to do, and people listen to them. And then he says, our world is like a small boat. No one knows when the bombs are going to go off. This was in the 80s when the sort of nuclear arms race was at the forefront of everyone's consciousness. And he's saying either that when we're able to attend to our own fear and panic and pain and heartbreak and overwhelm, we can actually show up. You know, and with, you know, somebody asked in the chat, like, why even look at the news if there's nothing I can do about it? I think we have a duty. I think we have a duty to bear witness to what's happening. And to try to help, to try. You know, as a new friend and colleague of mine, Anya Kamenetz, who writes about climate change and children, you know, she says, actually, it wasn't Anya. It was, I'm forgetting her name right now, but it'll come. Another local author here in the Bay Area was saying, you know, so, you know, if a boat is drowning and they say like, well, I can't do anything. I'm just, you know, no, you try to save the people you can. You try to help in some way you can. So whether it's just learning and educating ourselves so that we have a little bit more perspective and understanding of a very intense, complicated history, and can then listen with more empathy and compassion when others are inflamed, or whether it's finding organizations that align with your values and donating to them or sending aid. There are many things that we can do, and we need to look for those and find them, because as James often says, action relieves anxiety, right? Whether we're thinking about climate, refugees, war, doing something helps us also. Yeah, my heart's with you and with everyone over there on all sides who are suffering. Yeah.
I'm with you also, Ellen.
Thank you.
I'm going to add the spotlight. And yeah, I couldn't agree more with Oren as far as nourishing ourselves, even when it seems that, you know, the heart is breaking, that there's something healthy about remembering all the good in the world, along with our breaking heart. And this is not a cop out, but it's a if you aren't in the thick of things, if you have a choice, not everybody has a choice, but to remember to nourish your heart so you don't go under. And that's where good friends and things that uplift you can help you be that much more there for the sorrows. That's my last, that's what I'll be talking actually on Sangha Live, changing the channel, opening to goodness instead of being overwhelmed. So yes, we feel for you. Well, Oren, such a pleasure. I'm gonna to be with you and hear you share. And yeah, I highly recommend your new book, Your Heart Was Made for This, and your first book, Say What You Mean. Yeah, your clarity and good heart are really good medicine for us all. So we can just end with a short loving kindness, if that's okay. And just want to thank you so much for being with us. Hope you come back.
Thank you for having me. And thanks everyone for being here as well.
So we can just look at the screen. In fact, I'll just take down the spotlights so we can just look at each other. You can put it on gallery view. And for those who have their video on, just look and wish each other well. And know that that energy is coming to you as well. So let it in as well as sending it out. It's good to be with good friends, with like-minded friends. And from our virtual network here, just feeling how fortunate we are to meet on a Thursday evening and share the Dharma, hear some wisdom from a friend, and taking all of the goodness and the merit that we create here together and sharing it with the world, those who are suffering, those who, through their ignorance, cause suffering, those who are feeling well-being, and those who bring more happiness into the world. Humans, non-humans, all life forms, may all know inner peace. May all know real happiness. And may our coming here together be of benefit to all beings everywhere and the planet that needs our caring so much.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.